Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, you're listening to The Legacy Tapes, and I'm Rebecca Atkinson-Lord, and I'm here at the Tricycle Theatre with the rather marvellous Indhu Rubisingham, and we're going to be talking, as always, about legacy and the ideas of how you can or might choose to leave something lasting in this ephemeral medium of theatre. So, hello.
That very light subject matter.
That very light subject matter. Yeah. How long have you been here now?
Just over 4 years.
Just over four years.
I started in 2012.
Because it feels like it's transformed dramatically.
Oh, does it? Does it?
Yeah.
Oh.
Did you not know?
It's really hard when you're in it.
Yeah.
You don't see. Do you know what I mean? I don't see it from your... I see all the hard work.
Absolutely. Keep going. My colleague Rachel, who I was co-director at Oval House with, she always used to say, you've got 6 months. You start somewhere and you've got 6 months to remember how you saw it as an outsider.
Yes.
So that's when you've got to make your plans then, because after that, nothing will seem true anymore. So that's interesting. So how do you feel it, like it has changed or hasn't changed as an organisation? Like, what do you think?
Well, I know internally we did lots of changes because, you know, I was a different artistic director, had a different vision for the organisation and a different way of working and different relationships in the industry and stuff. So it's been huge changes, which I wouldn't necessarily assume has manifested itself externally because it's more operational, strategic thinking. So simple things like we plan a lot more in ahead than my predecessor used to. So, you know, how I program is very, very different. Mm-hmm. And how we communicate as a team is very funny. It's also interesting what becomes myth in an organisation and therefore becomes, people think it's a reality. Because I always remember when I started, it was unallocated seating. Yeah. I don't know if you remember. Everyone sort of was adamant that it couldn't go to allocated seating. And I used to hate the tension before a show of, like, the audience, like, waiting to get their seats and, like, you know...
The EasyJet vibe,
which isn't great when you're opening a show. And so I was really, really stressed about this. But everyone was adamant, couldn't be done. And then after a year, it took people a year of me going on, are you sure?
What were their reasons?
This is what I mean. I don't think it's like when something is said, it becomes people. The biggest lesson I learned is that actually nothing is changeable, is set in stone, because that was a really good example of something that people. It's not that I think it's not. They just sort of said, oh, you know, you've only got one aisle, you haven't got two aisles, there isn't enough exits and entrance, you'll need more ushers. You know, there was a whole list of reasons, which actually could be changed. And then we did change it. And like now, I don't think people remember when it was unallocated.
I think I just do. I remember seeing something and fighting for a seat. That's just a really interesting thing, those small structural things.
Yeah, but it's not small. Yeah, and it's not small because it's really key to how an audience experiences a theatre. Yeah. And you know, actually, that was one of the reasons I started the Capital Project, because everyone was saying, unless you reconfigure the theatre, you're not going to be able to go to allocated seating. And I was adamant that we had to have a better experience. So I didn't need to start the Capital Project. No.
But let's not tell anybody giving money that.
That was a joke.
So let's rewind back. No, let's rewind back 4 years. And when you... Psychologically, metaphorically. When you were writing that letter that said, I would like, you know, here's my hat.
Yeah, which was 5 years ago, actually, because I applied, you know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It takes forever.
Yeah.
What did you think you... Because, look, tell me if I'm misinterpreting, but as like as someone who thinks about as a curator, like if I'm applying for a job, it's because I know where I want to take that place in a really clear way. What was it that you wanted to shoot for as an outsider, like before you arrived?
It was really interesting because when I applied, I didn't know. What was really, really good was I didn't know if I wanted the job. I was very conflicted about whether I wanted to run a building. And so what I thought was, I'll apply and see. I mean, that isn't what ended up happening, but that's how I convinced myself in order to allow myself to apply. And what I loved about applying, because I didn't know whether I wanted the job, it was a genuine thing, a genuine statement of what I believe theatre should be or could be. It wasn't trying to get the job. It wasn't trying to impress the board.
Yeah.
It was genuinely what I believed in. So I really, really enjoyed that process. And it's something I sort of talk to other directors about, you know, kind of going, just write. It's almost like it becomes your personal manifesto.
Yeah.
Because when you're freelance, you don't realise the dots that connect your work. And that's what was lovely, was like kind of going, oh, actually, there is a pattern here with my freelance career, which makes it work in this building. So the vision, which I was very lucky enough to be able to change the mission statement quite early on to suit, because I suddenly realised, I saw my application and I was like, God, the ideas were there right from the application to what has been delivered. So the vision was about a place of unheard voices, being part of the mainstream, international, different lenses to the world. It was this mixing and a real exploration of the identity of not only the British identity, the global relations, and a celebration of that conflict and confluence, as well as a provocation. It was, you know, so that's what I talked about in my application.
Okay, and has that changed?
No. It's very. It's become more refined. It's become more polished. It's become more accurate.
Yeah.
But that vision was the seeds of that, or the kernel of that, is very much still what's happening.
Yeah. And do you? So this is one of the things that I always, that people give me different answers to, in that when you're thinking about how to deliver that and how to make change, like and how to instigate any kind of change or shift, or the effective word that doesn't sound too terrifying or risky to whoever you're talking to, do you think about, like, how far ahead do you think? Are you looking at day to day? Like, today we will do this, and today we will survive this, and today we will demonstrate this? Or are you looking at, in 20 years we're going to be?
I don't think 20 years.
Thinks
20 years?
All right.
Really?
I mean, you're doing a capital project. I hope you're thinking like 100 years.
Oh yeah.
Otherwise,
okay,
it's going to fall down.
Okay. Yeah. All right. No. I think, yes, it's really interesting question, because I think freelance, I barely thought 6 months ahead, you know, 6 months to a year was lucky. And then what's interesting with the job, the tension in the job, is actually being able to be strategic and long-term thinking and having the big ideas, and so that you can instigate change. But the job is so all-consuming, and theatres are so, like, something is happening every minute, every, you know, it's like you're firefighting or crisis managing, or like having to make immediate decisions in the day. So trying to, you know, I have this to-do list, which is like literally things I have to try and tick off today. But I try and keep in mind, like, the bigger picture ideas, like at the back of the book, so that I don't forget, because it's very easy to get consumed with the immediate things, tasks you have to grapple with. Sorry, what does that answer your question? No.
Yeah. I mean, it's how do you think about it? And the answer is both.
You have to both, but it's very hard to do both. It's actually nice at the moment to have the theatre closed, because actually a lot of my thinking is big picture thinking. Mm. And actually, I think it's dangerous, because we don't often get enough time as artistic director to do the brainstorming, to kind of go, okay, where would I like this? What the big sky, blue sky thinking is very hard. I've been able to do a lot more blue sky thinking more recently.
Yeah, it's really tricky, because just that sense that really what you need, you need like a year of you need to be so programmed so far ahead that you can take time to think deeply and meaningfully about what you're doing.
You need to be able to take holidays to be able to do that. You know, it's also, it's Yeah, it's the conundrum of the job, I have to say. And it's like that thinking that went into my application, I crave for it. Do you know what I mean? Because obviously now I'm much more better equipped and understand the job and, do you know what I mean, know what I need in a way that I didn't at all when I first did the job.
I wonder if there's something about... I sometimes think there should be a structure wherein you get to turn up and do the job for a bit, and then you get to redefine the terms on which you took it.
Yeah, that'd be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And they gave you a sabbatical so you could really think about it. Yeah. You could recoup.
Here's a couple of months, think about it. Ticket to the Bahamas. Throw that
very
in.
Very nice.
It'd be gorgeous.
Could you go on my board and suggest that?
Absolutely. I mean, no one will listen to me, but I'll happily shout into the wind. So then I kind of was wondering, a lot of how you talk about theatre and a lot of, like in the mission statement, it really manifests a sense of values and ethics. And I infer things about your understanding of theatre's place in the world. So I will ask this explicitly. Do you think theatre can change the world? Better question, why are you doing this?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. What surprises me about theatre, because on one hand, I don't think, you know, you put on something on stage and, at the most, a few hundred people come and see it. Mm. But, you reach, maybe 10,000 people, or, if you're at the National, maybe 20, 30,000 people for a show. So what real impact is that? I don't know the answer. So on one hand, it feels very, very minuscule and a pin drop. But there is something about theatre that even in this day and age, even with film, social media, technology, that really gets up people's noses, gets people up goat. You don't hear... Do you know what I mean? You don't hear Trump having a go at, a Spielberg film, but he has a go at a piece of theatre. It annoys him and gets up in his nerves, And it's like theatre... through the century, theatre has unnerved and political powers and, it's fascinating. So why I don't quite... I can guess. What I think is that theatre as a medium is very powerful. When it works, it has incredible power. Mm. It's almost a religious experience. It's a congregation.
Yeah.
It's actors who are shamanic and trying to transforming. And the idea, it becomes a sort of a sacred space in its purest form. In its original form, it's a sacred space
and
transformation
happens. And it does all the stuff
to
us physically that ritual does. Yeah. Our breathing. We match our breathing and our rhythms and that.
And so... there's that element. I love it because it's taken me to different worlds, different places, different ideologies. It's made me learn things personally that I would never, I doubt I'd come in, So it's the biggest thing for me is the empathy, the ability to walk in someone else's shoes without judgment, which actors have to do, which good storytelling does. And that's what I love about it. That's what I think personally grabs me is it's the without judgment. And I think we spend a lot of time judging people for whatever reasons, and I without thinking and making assumptions, and I'm interested in breaking those kind of perceptions. That's I think what drives me.
Okay. I was trying to think of how to explain what theatre does to someone the other day, because it's so tiny. If it's a fringe show, six people are going to see it.
Yeah.
It's so tiny. And they were a sailor. And this person was like, oh, like a barnacle. And I was like, what the hell are you talking about? And he said, well, when you've got a barnacle on the hull of a ship, the drag that it creates can massively... it can massively affect the speed and the turn and the... And that's what theatre is. It's this teeny tiny thing that just shifts incrementally the cultural consciousness.
Yeah.
And over a lifetime or a generation or a millennium, you've turned back on yourself.
Yeah.
If that's what you want. And I thought that was a really smart... I was like, yes, I steal that.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that. I'm going to use that now.
Yeah, because it's such a nice visual metaphor. And do you think of yourself as political?
Very interesting question. I think yes, but not in the way probably other people think I'm political. because I'm political in trying to say that I don't have to be political.
Tell me what other people think.
No, but I think there's an. What I mean is, like, I'm interested in. So yes, okay, let me go back. Yes, I am political in the sense that I think what I do, I want it to have an impact, and it's a comment, and it's an examination, and it's a reflection, and it's a refraction, and all those things. But it's through an emotional storytelling. It's through a narrative. So that I'm interested in character and emotional engagement and narrative. That, you know, I'm not interested in the political theatre. That's quite didactic. And sometimes we assume political, when we say theatre, is quite didactic, and it's on the tin, and you know what it's about.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm much more interested in the political of, like, putting someone on stage that you don't see on stage,
yeah,
or that you don't hear, so that they have their place on stage, that they're on the main stage. The other reason I sort of said that phrase was that, you know, I think by being an Asian woman in the industry, the assumptions are, you know, you're asked to comment and reflect and talk in a political discourse,
yeah,
right from the beginning of your career, which, you know, it's not that I'm against that, but I go, do you do that with my white counterparts?
Yeah.
No, you allow them to be artists. So my politics is to be allowed to be an artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. That's almost exactly what I wanted you to say. Yes. you can answer.
No, it's fine.
No. Because that must be, like, I'm aware of, like, having worked at Oval House, where such a big part of the agenda is to support those unheard voices.
Yeah.
And it's really easy to slip into the narrative that if you are brown, you must tell stories about being brown.
Yeah.
And the thing that came back again and again and again from artists with actually any kind of who claimed any kind of non-mainstream cultural identity or sexuality or, like, you know, any of those fucking identity politics boxes.
Yeah.
Was like, just let me do the thing. Let me tell the story. I have no interest in simplisticness. And no one ever came to me and said, I really need to tell the story about what it is. And I really need to tell the story about what it was to grow up black, for example. And I think that's... And there are artists that do that, but I feel like there's a real shift in the cultural narrative just now around identity as a context, not a subject in art.
I think that was always there. I just don't think it was given any airtime. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a different generational thing. You know, that's what we were talking about when I was starting. It was like the frustration of not, you know, and it wasn't, and it's not like, you know, I'm very proud of who I am and my, you know, but then it's a complex thing. But actually, then you sort of kind of go, actually, I'm less interested in what people think about, or what I think about me. I'm actually more interested in what's outside in the world, you know.
Because that's interesting, that's unknown.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think sometimes some of the, like, the othering, the kind of well-meaning othering of, like, I mean, what even is the mainstream? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
well, it's a white male heterosexual gaze.
Yeah.
That's the world that sort of has the power base and how that gives us our worldview.
Yes, I'm going to move on.
Yeah.
I feel like in quite a lot of these podcasts I start ranting about floppy head men, posh white men, and I should stop doing that.
Yeah.
I'm sure some of them are really nice. So talk to me about what you think the work, because so much of the work that you've been doing since you got here has been so successful. Like, I mean, fucking hell. Like, so successful.
Bless you.
What do you hope that the ripples of that are? Because, you know, if you think about, like, art as this pebble that drops into a pool, right? Or the ripples around the barnacle, right? What are the ripples?
Well, what I hope and I want to do more of, and what you hope is that you kind of go, what you show is that people are really interested in different narratives, unusual narratives, and that's what I hope we do here, is like, not the unexpected or kind of slightly off the beaten track stories, but by showing that they make box office, that showing that the audience are interested, you hope that the ripple effect is that other theatres feel, you know, will want to engage with different narratives and kind of that we, you know, my biggest hope is that once, you know, once you show that different stories and different lenses and, you know, the D word, diversity, is kind of value, and that means, i.e., it's a commercial success, everyone will engage with it. Everyone will want to do it. So that is the tiny little ripple effect I hope that I can help push forward.
Yeah. And I think money's a really useful... Like, I hate that everything comes through a capitalist construct, but it's a really easy way to prove the value of something if someone wants to buy it.
Yeah, but also, it's that thing of, like, you know, I was talking to a group of young artists, not young, but artists, and they were, like, kind of talking about process and stuff, and there was one conversation, he was slightly, you know, this not young, this middle-aged director was like, yes, but, you know, it'd be nice if you didn't know what you were doing and you just went into a rehearsal room and da-da-da, and he was, like, going off waxing lyrical. I said, yeah, but I have 4 weeks to make a show. I have 4 weeks. I have to have it designed. It's being built before I start rehearsals in order for it. We work under... It's not even just... Well, it is capitalism because we work under time constraints, which is money.
Yeah.
So I have to deliver. And, like, at the end of the day, especially as an artistic director, I have to do shows that sell tickets so that my staff stay employed. So, you know, when it becomes that low, so you can give me all the, you know, it's just interesting because those are the limitations to which...
Those are the structures we operate in.
And they're the constraints. But actually... there's an interesting way then to make them creative.
Yeah, it's like when you're improvising, the best way to make it interesting is put
rules
in place.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no vowels. Okay, so that's interesting. Do you think, because I think a big part of being an artist director that not everyone outside the theatre world thinks about is just that balancing act of art versus pragmatism and money and how you just balance it all. How do you think about risk and innovation? Because innovation isn't always a risk, so they're separate on the list. Risk and innovation and artistry versus more pragmatic commercial or financial concerns. Like, how do you balance that?
You're doing that all the time. You don't... It comes into... it's hilarious now. You kind of get really excited by an idea, but that someone's proposing it. Oh, you want to do it? Okay, how much... My first question on most things now is, how much does that cost? Or what... You know, what's the logistics of that? And, like, how many days... how many weeks rehearsal do you need and workshops? And how big's the cast? You know, my immediately first set of questions... which is not good, is often predicated on cost. And it's also being a bit, you know, like when curating a season, it's like kind of going, okay, I know that will sell, or I hope that will sell, I predict that can sell, and therefore that allows me to take a risk on this show that might not sell as much. You know, I also try and... even though we've broken a lot of the box office targets, I try and keep the box office targets low. And it's a real, it's a real argument between me and the executive producer. He says, look, we've got basis to in order to raise them.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like we're going, you know, we're pulling figures out the sky. But my issue is that if I feel the target's really high, it makes me scared. It makes me nervous. And therefore, if I get nervous, I won't take the risk. It's really important that I take the risk. And I create the scenario even if it's the false lying to myself, that allows me to take the risk. Because if I don't take the risk, then we're really stuffed.
Yeah. Vicky Featherston said a really interesting thing in her podcast that I thought... I was like, yes, thank you for saying that. And that she was saying that it made her... frustrated that there was so much talk about risk and financial prudence as binary opposites, and for her, she very much felt that risk and that continued innovation or exploration was what ultimately made things
financially successful.
Yeah,
absolutely, absolutely. I totally agree with that. But there's short-term and long-term, and that's the problem. I mean, I totally agree with that, because, like, you know, my, you know, the most successful shows, the lesson I've learned, my most successful shows here have been the shows that have been taken a huge risk, which people told me not to do.
Yeah.
And the things that I thought, oh, I'll do that because that will be conventional, that will be safe, have often, it's been the opposite. In fact, so I absolutely agree with that. But the big but is when, I mean, I've talked about it publicly, is like, you know, I've noticed it. If there's a lack of press interest in, I can correlate it in the Tri-School. When it's non-white work or non-white narratives, there is less press interest than when it's white mainstream interest. Mm-hmm. I put quotation marks, but and that, and you kind of go, that lack of support by the industry doesn't help the risk taking. So there's other factors. Not that it will stop me, but I can see why it would stop another organisation or someone else.
Yeah.
Knowing that, you know, you're likely to get a big article in a Sunday paper if you've got your star.
Yeah.
So that you know, we all hate that. I don't think even commercial producers love that idea. But we all hate that pressure of needing something like that to sell good product. So it's interesting. I totally agree. I think the more risks you can take, or the more investment you put up front, because I think when we sometimes take shortcuts because we think it's financially prudent, where actually it's not, because it doesn't help the show, and you're shortchanging the potential income.
Because people know when, like, things feel cheap.
Yeah.
Things feel...
Yeah, or you've just not quite got there because you've had a week less of rehearsals.
Yeah.
So I think... Yeah. And also, I think for the future of theatre, I mean, it's easier now not to take risks, but it will kill theatre in the future. Yeah.
Yes. Let me just go back to something you said about the press. Why do you think the press are less interested?
I think it's a complicated issue. I think arts editorial pages are getting less and less, so the fight for space is more. You know, it's also, they have to sell papers. They probably think their readership might not be, you know, maybe a decision based on, predicated on who they think their readership is. I don't know. I think there's a whole host of potential, again, economic and financial pressures and reasons. But it's just interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. I feel like if you have any, even the tiniest influence on the cultural collective cacophony, alliteration, I feel like there's a real obligation to be aware of what the voice you're putting into it does. And I don't have a lot of patience with... Form your thought, Rebecca. I don't have a lot of patience with the argument that this is what will sell papers. Because I feel like part of having a voice in the cultural narrative, it is to serve taste, of course, but it's also to shape and educate it.
Mm.
And I wish
But you could say, does the Daily Mail reflect taste, or does it shape taste?
I think it bloody shapes it.
Yeah, so I think papers do it. It's just which directions they choose to go into. I don't think it's what people think.
Easier to do it to the right for some reason.
Yes. Is it?
Well, I don't know. They seem to be more bloody successful, don't they?
Yeah.
That's a good thing. That's a good point, because why isn't there a rabid left wing chunk of the population that will attack people in the street for being fascists?
I think they're called Corbynites.
That's interesting. I bet quite a lot of our listeners are Corbynites.
Sorry.
No.
Well, no, you just hear about that, you know, the same kind of...
Yeah, the really, really old school lefties from the 70s. Okay, again, let's go back a little bit more, because you were talking about one of the first questions you ask when someone comes to you with an idea now is, how much does it cost?
No, I don't. I mean, that was me. I don't.
No, but you have a pragmatic head.
I do.
This isn't a judgmental question, because I'm aware that when I started work as leading an artistic program, I had such good intentions about art and process. Mm. And yeah, within like 6 weeks, I was like, okay. So pragmatically,
how do we make this happen?
Where's the money coming from? What do we need? Yeah. And it's about the pragmatism, because there's no point getting carried away with the art.
Yeah.
You know, you can't build your house until you've laid your foundation.
Yeah.
But then you don't want to bother laying a foundation unless you know the house is going to be awesome, right? It's a really tricky thing. I do like to speak in metaphors. So what's my question? Yeah, when you were a freelancer, how has that changed from when you were a freelancer? Did you think like that in the same way?
No, not at all, because I wasn't... Yes, of course I wanted the show to sell out. Of course I wanted audiences to come see the show, and of course I wanted to do it well and have critical success and stuff like that. So all those things were similar. But it didn't matter to me what the box office figures were going to be, you know. And that's the biggest shift, is that it absolutely... that's what I worry about, how are tickets selling? Every day, what the box office reports are, how much it's selling. Is it selling? Great. Okay, oh, God, we've got a problem here. We've got to start kicking, you know. Whereas, so it's a very different mechanism. And it's about... Yeah, so that's complete. I mean, it was really nice when I've directed at the National. It was just bliss, because I actually didn't care what the box office figures were. And it was suddenly that freedom of not having that responsibility.
And have you ever been in a position where you haven't cared about the box office, or you've had the freedom not to care about the box office, but at the same time, you know, you wanted an elephant on stage or something, and someone somewhere was crunching the numbers and saying no? Like, have you ever felt... As a freelancer, did you ever feel the limitations of financial pressure?
Yes, of course, all the time. But I think it is one of the prerequisites of working in the industry, of understanding how to work within a budget.
Mm.
It sort of slightly irritates me when people start getting a bit stroppy about their design, or, you know, the needing an... You know, it's one of the things you negotiate right up front and you work towards. And, you know, of course, again, it's like saying... You know, if I had 10 million weeks, my work would be amazing. It's like, yeah, if I had like £10 million, I'd have the most amazing set. Actually, okay, if you don't have that, what are you going to do? And what is, and you know, and I like that process of like, we can't quite afford it. Okay, how do we deliver those ideas?
Mm.
Because that's often some great creativity comes out in those moments, and a lot of rigor comes out in those moments. So, yes, but I think I've always been. I think I've always been that kind of... It's like the rules of the game. It's like, I'm a good girl. I'll play within the rules and, you know, use the rules in an interesting way.
Yeah. Yeah, it's much more interesting that way.
Yeah.
I really enjoy cooking. And my husband is rubbish at looking at what's in the fridge and making a meal.
Yeah.
Like, if there's a recipe and we shop for the... he has to shop for the recipe, and then anything else is wasted. And the thing I'm great at is going, okay, we've got this. We're going to have this. We've never had it before. It's going to be amazing. And I think there's a real, like, I think if you think about, like, when I'm thinking about art, making art, in a lot of ways, it's about, what are we going to have for tea? And what are we going to have for tea? There's what you would like for tea, which might be like roasted partridge. But actually, if what you have in the fridge is eggs and peppers, you're going to have an omelette. And the omelette will be wonderful, and it will be, and it's a creative act to make those things into something.
Yeah.
Because I'm a producer and a director, and those things are so symbiotic to me. I think I must be an absolute fucker to work with for other producers. Like, I apologise to all of them ever, because I'm there going, if I do this, does that buy me this?
Yeah.
You know, if I don't have an elephant, can I have an extra week's rehearsal?
Yeah.
And I think it must make producers' lives quite hard, but it makes my life much easier, because I know what...
You understand.
I understand, and I know what the trade-offs are and what something costs, like, aesthetically as well as practically. Okay, so when... So thinking about you with two hats, this is like a many part question with two hats. So when you go from this place, mm-hmm. and that is this physical building, mm-hmm. but it is also this metaphysical plane, mm-hmm. right, to mm-hmm. wherever you might go next.
Okay. You mean
not.
When I die?
When you die, okay. right? I tried to frame it nicely because really early on I was like, well, when you die, and someone was like, what? Why are you making me think about that? So when there is no more Indu, both here and in the world generally. Which is a sad thing, but what do you want to leave behind? And that, yeah, so that should cover both, like, when you are no longer artistic director here, what do you want this place to be? Or what do you want it to be becoming? And then what, you know, when the Guardian write your obituary in, like, 70 years' time, what are the things that you'd like to have endure?
Okay, well, let's start with the building first, because... Okay, so when I leave here, what do I want? I think whatever I want, it will not be what I want, because that is the nature of... No, what I mean is like, people take over buildings and new artistic directors come in and they do their own thing. Mm. So it's not for me to say... it's not for me to tie this place into anything that is permanent and can't be changed. But what I hope to leave behind is an essence or a smell of what had been before, of people feeling welcome, everyone feeling welcome. I hope that sense of different communities feeling welcome. I really hope that stays, because I think that's sort of politically what this theatre should be doing, considering its location. But hey, you never know. You can't predict what happens. And I hope lovely memories of people having had lovely times and amazing experiences, and kind of remember it fondly and emotionally. Mm. That's what I hope.
That's nice.
When I die. You know, I think this is really interesting, because having lost people, I think the biggest memory, the biggest thing that someone can give you is their love, their emotion, their impact on you personally. Mm-hmm. So I, as much as I'd love my productions to be remembered or have to affect people, people don't remember plays. I think very little of me will be remembered. It's a bit sad, isn't it? But apart from...
Only if you think that's value.
No, but, you know, I don't mean it like... But I think hopefully my impact on people will... whether it's through my friendships or through someone seeing a show or someone having worked here, that I'm just being realistic, rather than like, it'll be because I'll have changed the world of theatre. Do you know what I mean? You can wish for lots of things, but the reality is our effect on individuals. That's what lasts, and whatever that is, and I hope it's meaningful and positive, as opposed to thank the fuck she's gone. You never liked her.
Pain in the ass. Yeah, I think, because I wonder, I'm going to listen back to all of these podcasts, because I'm sure that I always say something different at this point. I think the thing that I would want is that people say, where she was, it was better.
Yeah.
And that means that I can be, it's that I loved them and they were not, and it made them happy. Or it can also be that I somehow changed the world.
But the thing is, like, if you have done that, they probably won't remember. They probably won't remember that's what you did, because it'll just happen and they won't quite realise why. And it just will be.
Yeah.
And they won't pin it to you. They'll just pin it to something.
I think that's okay.
That's what I mean.
Like, everything passes into nothing, right?
Yeah. Oh, God.
What's that poem? Ozymandias. Yeah. The statue in the... I don't know it off by heart. He comes across two great big feet in a desert land... And on the bottom it says, I am Ozymandias, King of Kings, look on my works, you mighty in despair. And this great big work has passed into nothing. I kind of like, I think yeah. everything should fade.
Yeah.
Okay, last question. If you... Well, last question, unless there were then interesting sub-questions. which there might be. If you could change one thing about the world on any level, right? On
no,
any fucking level.
No, you can't ask that
yeah, I can.
Question.
Oh, yeah, I can. What would it be? And you can think of it as like, you click your fingers and it has this subtle psychological change in people, or you can think of it as like a global law that is perfectly implemented. Like, you can think about it in a lot of ways.
And there's something about, it's something around religions and change. That's what a change. It's something about, like, yeah, it's some law that, from the beginning of time, that stopped people saying that your religion isn't right.
Hmm.
That, yeah. So you were you could have your own belief, but you couldn't undermine other people's beliefs. There's a tenet in Hinduism. I'm not saying Hinduism is great, you know, because there's ways it's practiced that hasn't been great. But what I've really liked about it is that it says different religions are different pathways to the same thing. So there's an absolute acknowledgement and respect for other religions in that tenet.
Yeah,
and you kind of go, I think that tenet should be in every religion.
Admit fallibility.
No, it's not no. I'm not saying that. You can say it, no, but you just sort of say your way is a different pathway to the same thing.
Okay.
So if there was that acknowledgement, then you wouldn't get intolerance. You wouldn't get this need for conversion. You wouldn't get this sense of conquering, because the biggest conquering religions have been Islam and Christianity, because it's all been about converting.
Mm.
You wouldn't, you know, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We probably wouldn't be in the shit we're in now with the Middle East, do you know what I mean? Between Islam and Christianity,
A lot of people wouldn't have died horribly.
Yeah.
In inventive ways.
We might not have even had the rise of the British Empire.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And if we did, it would have had a different, it would have had an economic rather than a cultural impact.
Yeah. We wouldn't have had, you know, this sense that, you know, if you don't believe in me, then you're not worth something.
Mm.
And therefore, your life becomes meaningless.
Mm.
Probably wouldn't have inequality, but you'd have individuality.
Mm. Yeah, there are very few gods that when you look into it, you don't think, well, you're a dickhead, I want nothing to do with you.
Yeah, no, exactly. Most religions, most of the tenets are really interesting and really fascinating. It's just when they start saying, but you can't believe in anything else.
Yeah. Okay.
That's quite a good one, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a good one. That's like a massive macro one. Yeah. I was going to go with something on like disposable plastic or something really not nearly as important. That's cool.
Oh, God.
is there anything that you feel like you want to expand, or you want to be like, this is the thing that I should have said?
No.
For that.
No, it was great. It was a great conversation.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Was that all right for you?
Yeah. Absolutely, because there isn't, like, there's not a right or a wrong. It's just about hearing your thoughts.